Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors. Asking the questions no one else asks. Creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
We are back on America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, I was talking to Eric Eyer about death in Mud Lick. And you might wonder, what the heck is that?
Well, is Mud Lick? Or what
Mud Lick, West Virginia. Okay. And it's a story of a coal country fighting against the drug companies that delivered the opioid epidemic. You remember?
Yes.
There's been some reporting on this. But what's remarkable about Eric Eyer is that he is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting. And I believe that award to him went to the person in the smallest newspaper ever to win the award. Wow. But he was dogged. He was determined to figure out what was happening in this community, and bless him.
Well, and in many communities around the country.
But in this particular community, they were dropping pills like they were placebos. They were dropping them into pharmacy there, and it was just a horrendous situation. It was so out of control, and so many people were profiting and benefiting and knew what was going on, and they allowed people to die as a result of this.
And how many people are we treating now for drug addictions and stuff because of it? I mean, it's just horrible.
Well, this goes into a lot of reporting that we're doing in the next period, both Death in Mud Lick, which you're about to hear, and then we did a wonderful interview recently that we'll be putting on in the fall with Gerald Posner on the pharmaceutical industry. And they do come back, both of them, to, well, the Sackler family, Purdue Pharma, very big here in the state of Connecticut where we are. And just at this moment, as the Massachusetts Attorney General prosecutes the Sackler family, we have states prosecuting doctors, nurses, and pharmacists. Eric Eyer, he illustrates what was really going on at the epicenter of this. How did it end up in his small community in West Virginia, where the opioid crisis was raging out of control? And he looked at it on a human level because he followed this woman, Debbie Priest, who really wanted justice in the death of her brother. And that led her to the legal office of Jim Cagle and Eyer's own shingle at the Gazette Mail in West Virginia.
Wow.
It's really remarkable. Yeah. And I give this guy so much credit. And interestingly, and I don't believe we left this on the interview, but at the end, I mean, he lost his job because local newspapers are really in deep trouble, John.
They
we
are.
Know that. And this was done right at the beginning of the pandemic, this conversation. It's only gotten worse. I've been reading about all these layoffs at newspapers, radio stations, even in our own state.
You think newspapers were the only ones ever, really, that did the deep dives into finding...
Well, almost any story, John.
Right.
Even if you see it on television.
Television never did it.
But assume that it started in a newspaper somewhere, and somebody said, well, let me go out and get some pictures to back this up. We need the newspaper. So
we really do.
Eric and I talk primarily.
Support your local newspaper.
Absolutely. Eric and I talk primarily, John, about the opioid crisis, but then we begin to talk about the crisis in our own local news reporting, because how many people are still out there like Eric Eyer to do the hard work that he did at the Charleston Gazette Mail? Not too many to do the investigative reporting, to take the time.
No.
And we know, John, we have reported on this, that in communities where you don't have a local paper, or you have one that has shrunk its staff so dramatically that everything they're taking is from a wire service or from another national source, so they're not covering the local beat. You know what happens?
Corruption goes up.
Thank you. And taxes go up too. So we really need to be mindful of what is going on with local journalism. We talked to Eric about that as well. So you're going to get two for the price of one today. We'll talk opioids, we'll talk about local newspapers, and we'll put it all together for you on America Trends.
Joining me on America Trends is Eric Ayer, who took home a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the scourge of opioid drugs in West Virginia and pinpointing the epicenter of the crisis to a small town, Kermit, and an overactive pharmacy preying on the hopelessness that existed in coal country. To follow on, he wrote the book Death in Mud Lick, a coal country fight against the drug companies that delivered the opioid epidemic. And yet, Eric, there were so many villains that I've got to go through with you, their various roles in this crisis that has emerged in America. But how much can we're talking about pinpoint what you were doing down there in your small newspaper, and just a wonderful achievement to get that Pulitzer Prize for the Charleston Gazette Mail. How much can we attribute your work to what later was a follow-on by so many states, attorney generals, cities, in terms of going after the drug companies?
Well, it all sprung from my stories, but I wasn't the only one doing this kind of work. There was a lawyer by the name of Jim Cagle, the Charleston lawyer who filed the initial lawsuit against the drug distributors. There was Debbie Priest, who is a main character in the book. She lost her brother to an OxyContin overdose back in 2005, and she and Jim Cagle followed the case up until it got from starting out with a doctor that prescribed the opioids to her brother to the pharmacy that you mentioned in Kermit that distributed millions and millions of pills based on fake and phony prescriptions. And then up to the drug distributors, and those are the big Fortune 500 companies that ship drugs from the manufacturers to the warehouse to the pharmacy. So there was a number of people, and then we had help, and probably get into this later, but we had a lot of help from a law professor in West Virginia University. He and his wife worked for free for us pro bono to pry loose the records that exposed the secrets and lies of these drug companies that delivered the opioid epidemic.
But the pushback really began with you and your work and all those people who were involved with you. That is a remarkable thing to turn the tide, because these opioids that were really coming into vogue when I remember in the 90s, doctors were all talking about pain as kind of the last frontier of what they wanted to conquer, and they were all hailing these miracle drugs that they could now use. But then they began abusing them, doctors, pharmacies, middlemen, I mean, up and down the line, politicians looking the other way. I mean, how did it get to such a boiling point where we were losing so many lives and so many families destroyed in the process?
Well, I think it boiled down to greed. You had, greedy doctors who were writing prescriptions for, $150, $200 a prescription without really even talking to the patient. And then you had, pharmacies that were filling these prescriptions, knowingly filling these prescriptions that the doctors were working at these illegal pain clinics. And then you had the companies that, just unfettered shipments. There were some cases where some of the people farther down the chain for the companies tried to blow the whistle, but they were kind of brushed aside. But you had companies who were doing these unfettered shipments. So you had everybody kind of working in concert. Oh, and you had federal regulators that were turning a blind eye to the problem, too. So you had everybody, you had the doctors blaming the pharmacists blaming the doctors, and the distributors blaming the doctors and the pharmacists, and nobody really was pointing the finger other than at somebody else.
Yeah, well, it was so fascinating in your book that we had all these accidental drug overdoses skyrocketing in your state, And the first instinct of the state was simply to blame the addicts and say that if they sued, they could have no monetizing of any of that. I mean, so they were trying to pin it on the addicts themselves.
Right. And we actually, we had the case, originally, Jim Cagle, the lawyer I mentioned earlier, he represented 29 residents of Southern County in West Virginia and a county in Kentucky who sued the pharmacists and the doctors. And the response from those that were sued was, you can't sue us because these addicts were acting illegally. That went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the majority has shifted now, but at the time they did vote 3-2 that the addicts could sue. I shouldn't use the word addicts, but people with opioid use disorder would be the better way to put it. But then after that decision came down, the legislature in turn quickly marched up to prevent that from happening, to prevent, you know, people with opioid use disorder or, you know, who admitted to, you know, obtaining pills illegally from them from ever filing suit against, really against anybody related to, you know, the harm that it had caused them personally. So
yeah, but these were, I mean, addictions that resulted from a legal prescription that had been put forward by unscrupulous and, as you say, greedy purveyors of it, whether they're the middlemen providing it, whether they're the drug companies themselves looking away and not wanting to know that the product was being misused and abused. So, I mean, there were so many, and this was legal. I mean, these were legal pills. Now, I know that the opioid crisis has both a legal and an illegal side, that if after you can't get the legal pills, then many people turn to something that gives them the same effect, and that being heroin in many cases. But here, we're talking about the legal side of this.
The legal side, but at the same time, you know, these doctors were not seeing their patients. People would just go in and say, oh, my back hurts, and I'll write you a prescription. Of course, you know, you had Purdue Pharma and its team of marketing people who were descending on the state like locusts, telling everybody that these OxyContin pills at first, and then it shifted to hydrocodone, but the OxyContin was not an addictive drug. Of course, we know that's not true. And then you had the pharmacies who, you know, knew that, for instance, you know, you had pharmacies and pharmacists filling prescriptions in West Virginia for doctors in Tennessee and Ohio and Washington, D.C., places that were like 4 or 5 hours away, and where the doctors were prescribing the pills, and patients were flocking to Kermit and other towns in southern West Virginia to get their prescriptions. So the pharmacists absolutely knew what was going on, and they just turned a blind eye because they were making millions of dollars on millions of pills.
Yeah, and to add insult to injury, in your state, the attorney general who came in the process, I believe, if I recall correctly, of a lawsuit, he said, well, we will prosecute, but I've got to recuse myself because his wife was the lead lobbyist or one of the lead lobbyists for Cardinal, one of the major suppliers of these drugs. We only have 3 major suppliers of pharmaceuticals, and they being one of them. And, of course, even though he recused himself and the case continued, you got information, and I think it was left at your doorstep, that, in fact, he was very much involved.
He had said he recused himself, and we asked for a copy of the letter where he had recused himself, and he said it was an oral recusal, which we had never heard of. In a normal law office or attorney general's office, you set up sort of a Chinese wall where you things separated. But we actually went to court. You know, we got wind that there might be some documents or some emails that showed that he hadn't in fact recused himself or stepped aside from the Cardinal lawsuit that was filed by his predecessor, as you mentioned, the former attorney general, who was a Democrat, and our new attorney general was a Republican. So we went to court, and we actually, filed a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, and we actually lost the case. And then lo and behold, a couple weeks later, I get a text from my son. He says, "Dad, some guy just got out of a car and put an envelope in our mailbox." My son didn't see the person. It was really quick. I guess they ran up to the porch and dropped it off. And then I went to the mailbox and came home and found that it was in fact an email that showed it was written by the Attorney General's chief deputy that things, you know, what the Attorney General wanted to do in terms of how to proceed with the case, and also there was information that he wanted to be at court hearings in which Cardinal Health's case was discussed. So it seemed like, you know, to us that disproved his statements that he had recused himself in the time he took office in January 2013.
Just to help the listener understand how ridiculous the situation had gotten, for example, in small, Kermit, West Virginia, let's go to the Save Right Pharmacy and set the picture for us that you did so beautifully in the book of what the parking lot looked like, what the activity level was, and the number of pills for the number of people per capita in the community.
You know, there were stories in the search warrants. There was information in the search warrants, and also we have videotape. But you had cars, you know, people coming from 100 miles away from Virginia to Maryland to Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., and they were, you know, flocking to this Save Right. It got so crowded and you know, the cars were so backed up that they set up a trailer on the parking lot of Save Right to sell hot dogs and candy and soda pop to keep the customers happy. And inside, if you had to wait, they had popcorn to hand out to the customers that were waiting. But it was just this, you know, steady stream of people, nonstop. You know, like I said, there's upwards of, in this one small town of 382 people, you had upwards of nearly 9 million hydrocodone pills or prescription opioids in just 2 years. So it was just, the thing was, when they asked the pharmacist, well, you know, why are all these people coming from all over the place? He said, "Oh, it's just because he said that we have the best prices." Of course, somebody had to pass by like 20 pharmacies to get to his pharmacy. And then the other one was that it's tourists because they have a big ATV trail, the Hatfield and McCoy trail, that a lot of people come in. But I wouldn't think that they would be coming in to going to a pharmacy while they were here to ride their ATVs.
No.
So it was quite a spectacle, I guess.
Stay with us for more of this great conversation in just a moment. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at bloomshapiro.com.
Eric Ayer is with us. Death in Mud Lick, a coal country fight against the drug companies that delivered the opioid epidemic, and they had so many accomplices. How long did this really go on? The pursuit that you and others and the lawsuits and the like, how long did that take? And just remind us, when we begin to see other attorneys general in other states and cities, municipalities, really beginning this effort to push back against these excesses. And there were excesses everywhere, perhaps not as visibly, available to us as in West Virginia. But tell us how long this whole process took to really begin this pushback against opioids.
The reporting started in 2013 and is still going on today. Just to mention a couple of the highlights or the breakthroughs. I guess back in, the biggest breakthrough was back in 2016. We got wind that they had, that the state had, the Attorney General had revised his lawsuit. It was called the Second Amended Complaint. And they had new allegations in terms of numbers of pills. But that lawsuit that was filed by the state was filed under seal. And here you have a complaint, you know, filed on behalf of the citizens of West Virginia that's under seal, that's hidden from the public. And we thought that was just outrageous. And, you know, I called the law professor, Pat McGinley, at WVU, and I said, Pat, is this normal? And he said, absolutely not. He said, you know, I said, well, how do we go get this? And he said, well, we'll have to intervene in the case, and then we'll have to file a motion to intervene and to unseal the documents. So we went to court, this tiny town in southern West Virginia, Boone County, where it was filed. We went to court, and we walk in. I remember to this day, that first day, I walked in with Pat, and there, sitting in the rows of, you know, the courthouse, are like 30 to 40 lawyers, and I'm hearing them talking that they're coming in from Washington, D.C., from Philadelphia, from Columbus, Ohio, you know, all from some of the top law firms in the country. And here, you know, is me, you know, here me and Pat are taking on these giants. And then I started that's kind of when I first realized, you know, this is a big deal. So we, you know, to kind of summarize it, we went to court. It was a long battle. And at the end of the day, a local judge unsealed the lawsuit. And that's when we got the first glimpse at some of these large numbers. But there was more within that lawsuit. It kept citing these numbers, referring to DEA, that's Drug Enforcement Administration data. DEA data shows, DEA, according to DEA data. And so I said, well, you know, we need to find out about this DEA data. So I talked to some people, and they said, well, you don't have to go very far, Eric, to find that DEA data. And I said, why not? Because they said, you know, I worked down at the state capitol, at the press room at the state capitol, because I covered the legislature at the time. They said, you just go upstairs. It's in Patrick Morrissey's office, the attorney general. So I said, I doubt he's going to give it up, but let's try it. We filed a Freedom of Information Act request. He sat on it for 2 months, but we were fortunate enough that he had an election, a reelection campaign coming up, and we pressed him during a press conference, and he reluctantly released spreadsheets where we got all these numbers that showed every shipment of pills to every pharmacy in the state. It divided them up by counties as well. So we had a clear roadmap of where all these pills went. And then we matched that up with the overdose death rates in those counties. And the counties with the highest overdose death rates also had the highest number of prescription pain pills.
And how much of this spread throughout Appalachia? In other words, was it only in West Virginia or Kentucky, parts of Ohio? And was it that these companies felt that maybe regulations were more lax or the people more desperate because of the coal industry, a lot of back injuries, whatever it may be, or a lot of coal mines shutting down and people in a place of despair? Why was it that you were the epicenter as you see it?
Well, I think there was a lot of despair and hopelessness, and you know, the typical story was, you know, you had a lot of people doing backbreaking work, literally, you know, working in the coal mines. Debbie Priest, who I mentioned earlier, her brother got injured in a coal mine accident. And then, you know, typically they'd start with a legitimate doctor and get prescribed Oxycontin or hydrocodone, and then once they got addicted, they'd get cut off, and then they'd find their way to one of these notorious pain clinics. Usually had names like the Wellness Center, that type of thing. That's kind of how it started.
So there were a number of factors involved. When did you sense that there was really a villain in here. I mean, your book, the subtitle suggests that it was the drug companies, but a lot of what I read into the book was about the drug distributors' greed. And then if we're looking at, well, smaller fish, of course, the drug companies are the biggest fish, then the drug distributors, then you had the doctors and pharmacies all throughout the land, and in this case, we're putting a bright light on West Virginia. But who do you really look to as being the most out of control of all the profiteering that went on?
That's a hard one. I mean, they all bore responsibility. Again, you know, you had doctors writing, you know, prescriptions that they knew somebody was addicted. You had pharmacies that were just, you know, filling them from clinics that they knew were illegitimate. And then you had the companies that were just, you know, unbridled shipping to these small towns. I mean, there was instances, it's shown up in the court documents later, that, you know, some of these warehouses for some of the big companies like McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen, you had people at these warehouses saying, hey, hold on a minute. You know, these people are exceeding their monthly, they had thresholds in place, and they're exceeding their monthly thresholds by, like, you know, 40 times. I mean, your typical pharmacy in the United States would probably dispense, you know, 60,000 OxyContin doses for pills per year, and you know, you had places that were doing a million OxyContin pills.
Yeah. It's ludicrous, really, on the face of it.
You had people that were, and they even sent people to some of these companies sent people to these pharmacies to check it out, so to speak. And all they did, there's been, you know, emails that were released that came out during a congressional investigation that followed our coverage. And they, you know, they would say, are you doing things right? And then the pharmacist would say, oh, yeah, I'm doing things right. And then they would just walk away and just continue to ship. I mean, in the case of Sabrite, you had McKesson, the largest distributor in the country, was shipping there. It got raided and shut down, and they stopped shipping because they couldn't, because it was closed. Then it reopened, and they started shipping to them, the same owner, the same people involved. The McKesson started shipping to them again, you know, another 2-3 million pain pills.
Now, the DEA, I think a lot of people would wonder, West Virginia, there was a lot going on there with the new attorney general, and a lot of people looking away, and lots of people who were benefiting in some way. What about the DEA? And even later, when the states got involved, I mean, who really picked up the ball from where you took it, and your attorney and others who were involved? And I don't want to forget Debbie Priest and all of this. But you mentioned the name Joe Banazizi at the DEA, who I think really started to take this seriously. But when did the feds and the states really begin to pull together on this? And who really led the way? Was it more the states or the federal government? And I say that because we're in the midst of another public health crisis right now with coronavirus, and everybody's wondering who's in charge here. So I'm just wondering who took charge of the opioid scourge and began to make certain that we had serious regulation, much more so than we had had for many, many years this went on.
Well, you had many parts to that question, so let me start with the first part and then remind me later of the second part of what
sure.
exactly, if I don't answer at all. So at the height of the opioid epidemic in West Virginia, we had two DEA agents, to cover the entire state for diversion of opioids or, you know, any kind of controlled substances, too. And one of them committed suicide, so they were left with one. You know, that was just, you know, an absolute shame, because, you know, you can't cover the entire state with one diversion investigator. By contrast, now they have about a dozen here in Charleston. So, you know, you had this idea of just so few. And then the DEA, you had Joe Ranazizi that was trying to do the right thing. He met with top executives as the distributors back in 2007, said, you know, guys, we've got a problem. these shipments are out of hand. And so they made pledges that they were going to, you know, rein in their shipments. They made pledges to submit what they called suspicious order reports that would, when a pharmacy ordered an excessive number of opioids, they'd submit a report. But they didn't do any of that. They just ignored all those promises that they had made Joe Ranazzisi. And at one point, Joe Ranazzisi was essentially shut down by the higher-ups of the DEA, more likely the Department of Justice actually shut him down. And then your question was, well, what kind of turned the tide?
Was it the states more so than the federal government? Because we're now in the midst of this other public health crisis, and we've got the states and the federal government trying to parse out whose responsibility, what elements of this are. And when you look at it, I mean, who do you think really came in? Was it attorneys general across the country?
Well, from the state perspective, the legislature passed new rules in terms of prescribing, limiting, restricting. You couldn't go get your 90 OxyContin pills in one prescription anymore. You couldn't get them phoned in.
Right.
On the federal level, they put new restrictions on hydrocodone in terms of it was much more difficult to prescribe. You know, it was kind of a mix of both. I know that after the stories came out, the DEA came here, and, you know, they said we had the guy that was in charge said, you know, we had a lack of manpower in the state, and now we're going to bring, 12 agents. And this was kind of after, as you mentioned earlier, the problem had shifted from pills to heroin, then to fentanyl, and now to meth. But, you know, they talked about, also he talked about this revolving door where you had DEA agents would go to work for these same drug distributors as their compliance officers. So it was all kind of a cozy.
Yeah, I think I recall a report on 60 Minutes about that. So you're saying now that the issue as it relates to those particular opioids has been at least restricted to some degree, but people have moved on either into other legal, I would imagine, painkillers of one sort or another. I know a lot of people are talking about CBD, I mean, even though that's not a prescription. And then you're saying that we went to more to the heroin, the fentanyl, and now meth again. So where are we today as it relates to what started as a legal pill problem with opioids? Where do you think we are today?
Well, I'd say the biggest problem we have now is meth, which is not an opioid, but it's getting mixed with fentanyl, and that's causing the large number of overdoses. On the plus side, they have done a pretty remarkable job in reducing deaths in terms of they distribute Narcan or Naloxone.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has it here. Just about everybody carries it. You can get it down at the pharmacy. So if somebody overdoses, it really works miracles. It reverses the overdose very, very quickly. They go from, barely even able to breathe to, they wake up and they don't even remember what happened. So we had the first decrease last year, a slight 7% decline in overdose deaths after they had increased, year after year after year, probably, 10 or more years consecutively increasing. We had a slight, the high was upwards of 1,100 overdose deaths here, drug overdose deaths, and that started to ebb a little bit last year. Now, with this coronavirus, in this age of coronavirus, I'm worried that the coronavirus, the pandemic may exacerbate the opioid crisis, so we may see some.
So are people using in the ICUs and all, because obviously they're trying to reduce the pain that a lot of people are going through, are you reporting or hearing that they are using these opioids again?
I haven't heard that. That'd be something to look into. But in terms of people who have COVID-19, if they're using opioids, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, whether that's one of the things they're using to relieve pain.
I haven't heard that. I really don't know that.
Okay, let me move on to ask you a couple of other. There's so many other areas I want to get into in a short period of time. Have the pharmaceutical companies paid enough of a price in any of this?
to be persuaded that this kind of behavior or looking away or promulgating, some practices that led to this destructive activity all across the nation and really became public health crisis number one. And I say that because we see so many other things that come into public health view, like vaping and these flavored products, or just a myriad of things. We're even going to have lots of products, I'm sure, that people are going to be putting on the market saying this is going to ward off the return of the coronavirus or whatever it may be. And so I'm just wondering whether, just as in the past, we've always wondered whether after the 2008 financial meltdown, the banks learned their lesson and whether they were scolded enough or enough people went to jail. What do you think in this particular case?
Well, I think the people here in our state who have lost loved ones don't feel that the drug distributors and the pharmacists and the doctors have paid a sufficient price. Some of these companies get fined $30 million. Well, they're making, billions and billions of dollars every year, so that's just a slap on the wrist. To date, they face a lot of shame and humiliation during the congressional investigation, which was a year and a half ago. They had to come to before Congress and stand up and talk about whether or not they felt that they played a role in the opioid crisis. The big three that we talked about earlier, all those CEOs said no, but one regional distributor said yes, and that regional distributor is now bankrupt, and they're paying the price because several of the executives, the ones that admitted that they played a role, are now facing indictments and conspiracy charges with various pharmacies. So, but in terms of the big three, they're sort of preening right now in terms of the coronavirus response, getting needed medical equipment to hospitals. They're in press conferences with the president on TV.
Are we talking about McKesson Cardinal?
Yes.
And AmerisourceBergen?
Yes. Yes.
Mm. Well, let me say this, that when I look at this story and your remarkable reporting throughout, there are a number of underdogs. So, folks, if you want to read a great book and root for somebody, you can root for Eric, and you can root for the woman who mourned the overdose death of her loved ones, or there's a great lawyer involved here, very colorful. So, I mean, there are people. But I look also at you representing a small-town newspaper, because that paper, wow, I mean, there's a great story behind it, but we know that local journalism overall as a trend in America is really facing so many hard times with all of the competition, and this period makes it even more difficult because a lot of advertisers are closed, and so we're going to see perhaps more newspapers go under. But the pressure that you and your newspaper were under was enormous, but the courage that you had to continue and pursue is truly remarkable.
Yeah, and we actually went bankrupt. But like you were saying, I'll echo that. Every crisis that we have, it reminds us of the importance of local journalism. And in this day and age of coronavirus, it's hastening the decline of local news outlets and community papers across the country. Like you said, readership's at an all-time high for these local newspapers like ours, but advertising is plunging, is collapsing. Our revenues are collapsing. All across the country right now, newspapers are shutting down. Places are laying off scores of reporters. The largest chain in America, the Gannett chain, has put reporters on furlough. And this is really a difficult time because you have reporters busting their butts trying to, report the story, but you have photographers putting their lives in danger, going to stores, going to public places, only to turn around and be laid off or let go. I myself got a call last week to meet with the owner, and this was following a spate of layoffs in our newsroom, three layoffs the week before last, and another two the weeks before, and I got a call that, it's you need to come down to the newsroom to meet with the owner and the comptroller. Now, the comptroller's not there. That's the money person. That person's not there to
to talk about your last piece.
To talk about my last coronavirus story. So I kind of tried to get ahead of it, and I actually, this was on the day of my book launch, I get this email, and I'm like, well, what do I do? And I just thought it through, and I said, well, I'm not going to, first off, I didn't want to drive down to the newsroom, and secondly, I didn't want to put myself through that. So I turned in my resignation that very afternoon on the day my book was launched.
Really?
So I currently don't have a job. I thought maybe, you know, by resigning, I might spare one of our younger reporters. We've got so many great young, enthusiastic reporters. I've got this book. I've got chance to talk about it. But, you know, these reporters are getting paid, you know, $30,000 a year or less, and out there, again, busting their asses. And, I thought maybe it might spare one of our younger reporters if I stepped aside.
And I'll tell you, as somebody who's an older broadcaster, and when I see how much has changed in my field, and then I look at what goes on with a newspaper reporter today, who is also a videographer, who's also a blogger, who's also a photographer. I mean, the requirements and the skills that are needed in composite are pretty remarkable. And then you look at the pay, as you say, it is amazing the quality of work that we still get.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a call, like a call of duty. I mean, you've got reporters there now, and they said, you know, at our paper, and it's not just us, it's everywhere. I mean, Cleveland Plain Dealer, I think yesterday laid off 20-some reporters. I mean, pretty much shut down their whole newsroom. So they know it's coming at some point. I talked to a photographer last night that had been there for 30 plus years, and he's like, I know it's coming, but I feel it's my duty, it's my calling to serve the readers, to serve the public, to keep citizens informed. Knowing that, you know, next week we're going to come in with more cuts, so the week after that there's going to be more cuts. It's incredible work that reporters are doing under incredible stressful conditions, you know, knowing that they could possibly lose their jobs.
And their lives. Let me ask you this in closing. Here we are in the midst of another public health problem, a terrible problem, epidemic, pandemic. You've just done some of the most remarkable reporting in the country on the one that we were all focused on for the longest period of time. What is it? Because we're going to be turning now to some of the same people who you exposed in this book as really having other motivations beyond just the good of the public. What should we watch for in this particular crisis? Because some say within crisis is always an opportunity for some. What do you look to, given your background and your understanding of the way the pharmaceutical company works?
Yeah, I think they're going to be looking at profits. I mean, one example is there was a that ties directly between coronavirus and the opioid epidemic is that there was a call that was tape recorded by The Intercept, an online publication, where you had investment bankers talking with these companies that distribute opioids. How can you leverage coronavirus to dodge and duck responsibility for the opioid epidemic? I mean, they're facing, you know, the last we heard there was a settlement in the works for $50 billion. You know, how can you lessen that liability by performing now? I think there's, you know, this, with all this stimulus and all these corporate bailouts, there's going to be just this tremendous, there's going to be waste, fraud, and abuse beyond what you ever could imagine. And thank goodness there's, you know, reporters, not just local reporters, but the people on the national level too, you know, standing by, doing the hard work to hold these public officials, to hold these corrupt companies accountable, because if they don't do it, I don't know who will.
Well, you've talked about the depletion in many of these newsrooms
We also have inspectors general who are being fired at this time, who are there to oversee some of the outflow of this money. So there's a lot for us as the public to keep our eye on, because somebody at some moment in time in the future, our kids and our grandkids are going to have to pay this money back. Eric Ayer, remarkable work, and I know that things will go well for you as you continue to report on this. I don't know for whom, but I can't imagine somebody's not going to snatch up the capability that you've demonstrated, the Pulitzer Prize that you've won. Death in Mud Lick, a cold country fight against the drug companies that delivered the opioid epidemic. Thank you so much for being with us on America Trends.
Well, thank you for the great conversation. Really appreciate you having me on.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.